You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it is wonderful to see you all this afternoon, and welcome to the Brookings Institution. And we don't have an extra chair in the House, and many standing in the back. So we're very, very grateful for this attendance today. My name is John Allen. I'm the president of the Brookings Institution, and it really is a pleasure to welcome you all here and to welcome the many of you who will be coming in over our webcasting process today as well. Today we're going to discuss some of the major economic shifts that have left millions of Americans behind and that have changed what it means and what it feels like to be in the middle class of America. These shifts, which include widening inequality and the loss of jobs to trade and technology, have been well documented. But especially as we move towards the midterm elections, we take a hard look at the future of our great nation. We at Brookings are looking hard for solutions. During today's event, you'll hear from our Brookings senior fellow, Bell Sawhill, one of our greats here at this institution, whose new book launching today, The Forgotten Americans, puts forward a concrete policy agenda to bridge economic and cultural divides. The ideas outlined in her book demonstrate not only decades of her experience as one of the country's leading experts on anti-poverty programs, but also the pragmatism needed to make progress in today's divided political environment. It's an agenda that, in her own words, mirrors and marries red state values with blue state policies. And so to that end, we also welcome today two honored and distinguished guests, Governor John Kasich from Ohio, from the great state of Ohio, and Governor John Hickenlooper from the great state of Colorado. These gentlemen, to me, represent some of the finest examples of American leadership that one could find. They're public servants of the highest caliber and set, in my mind, the perfect example for how, even in an America that seems often divided, more divided than unified, they embody the virtues of bipartisanship, respect, and civility. And these qualities shine through in them all day, every day. And to that end, the governors are here as well in Washington to jointly receive the Publius Award. And it's an award for bipartisanship in government, which is being awarded to them tonight by the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. No two Americans could be more deserving of that award. And gentlemen, we congratulate you on behalf of the Brookings family. Well done, sir. And so for what's next, the governors will kick off today's event by sharing their own valuable perspectives on the critical issues impacting our cherished middle class, and then we'll go out to the audience for Q&A. They'll be interviewed by our very own Richard Reeves, who, among other activities at the institution, directs our Future of the Middle Class Initiative and is the co-director of our Center for Children and Families. I'll also highlight the fact that his book, The Dream Hoarders, is still, in my opinion, one of the great books on the plight of the middle class that one could read. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's going to be a wonderful discussion, and this gathering represents more than anything the importance of bipartisanship and bipartisan cooperation and the value that we place on that at this institution and more broadly in America today. And one final housekeeping note, this is on the record, and it is live. So with that, let me invite the governors and Richard to the stage, and thank you, gentlemen, so much for joining us today.
Thank you, John. Let me add my welcome to all of you here, and in particular to our two distinguished guests. I've already just added a life goal for myself, which is the next time I publish a book, I would like not one but two governors to turn up to the book launch. Bell's setting the bar pretty high as usual. The governors, as you've heard, have plenty in common, not least their commitment to bipartisanship. They're both coming to the end of their second term as governors. I think sprinting to the end would be a fair summary. They're born in the same year. And so there are a number of similarities, but some differences too, as we'll discover. Their states do have some marked differences, of course. Doing a little bit of research this morning, discovered that something like 15% of the residents of Colorado now use marijuana. I don't know if that number has changed. Whereas a very high number of people in Ohio regularly drink tomato juice. And it turns out that tomato juice is, in fact, the official beverage of the great state of Ohio, which may explain it. So differences, but some similarities. So, we will not, I think, be discussing marijuana policy today, but who knows where the conversation will take us. So we're obviously going to be talking about the group that Bell calls the forgotten Americans, the middle class, but I want to start a little bit broader than that. I want to start by talking about the state of liberal democracy, where we are at this particular juncture, especially, of course, in the US, but including in some other countries too. How bad is it? How bad is the challenge? How great is the challenge? And do you think that it's primarily an economic challenge? Governor Hickenlooper, you've written and spoken a lot about income inequality and wealth inequality. Or is it primarily a cultural challenge? Governor Kasich, in your State of the State this year, you highlighted issues of mutual respect and personal responsibility and the kind of culture that supports liberal democracy. So are we looking here at primarily an economic challenge or a cultural one? Governor Kasich, let's start with you.
Well, it's great to be here with my running mate. That can be taken a number of ways, okay, here in Washington. No, I love John. It's always fun to be with him and work with him. And our
he told me that you were his running mate.
Yeah. If you figure out how to get it all on a bumper sticker, we can talk. So I think it's both, actually. I think there is a cultural side of this. If you look at Bavaria right now and what's happening there and the idea that we want to keep Bavaria pure German, and we don't really like the idea of migrants. And, you know, I think there's an element of ethnicity or whatever you want to call it, cultural upheaval about preserving our values. But I think there's also this problem of the division between the haves and the have-nots. And so I think both of them really are in play. And solving them is a great challenge. Here in the United States, I think we face, in many aspects of our society, what I've been talking about recently called the zero-sum game, where, you know, I win and you lose. And I remember the days when we could win but give somebody who didn't win something so that everybody could walk away in a victory. And the zero-sum game, whether it is in college athletics or whether it's in politics or business, you know, people say, oh, we got the quarterly report. Well, I mean, yeah, if you want to pay attention to that's all you pay attention to, good luck. You know, I have to win and you didn't and my earnings are better. And it's just, I don't think life works very well when we operate in a zero-sum game. So I think these are complicated issues that need to be addressed, because if they're not addressed in some significant ways, things are going to result in conflict, and conflict results in very bad things worldwide.
Thank you. Governor Hickenlooper, you've described trickle-down economics as a fairy tale, and you seem worried that not that people are winning, but that the winners are taking so much of the winnings now. I don't know if that's a fair characterization of your views, but...
Well, I think we're facing a bifurcated world, and I agree with Governor Kasich, who really would be, if I was ever going to run with a Republican, this would be the one I'd run with.
Okay.
I think part of its policy for, I don't know, 30 years, 40 years, we've been focusing on narrow implementations of corrections to various inequalities within our form of capitalism, and really not addressing some of the larger scale issues. So we've gone through the end of the Industrial Revolution, where we really reduced the cost of commodities and reduced the cost of shipping. Again, the ability to concentrate wealth rather very rapidly. And that led into what we're now seeing, the beginning of advanced automation, artificial intelligence. That's only going to put more jobs at risk, whole professions at risk. And we did nothing, right? In the 1980s and the 1990s, as not just individuals lost work, but whole professions got decimated through these improvements of productivity, our political system kind of said, and I know this because I came out to Colorado as a geologist in 1981 and had 5 great years until the price of oil collapsed, and then our company got sold, and everyone got laid off. And I went through it. They did bupkis in terms of trying to train you or prepare you, help you get to a new career. They sent you to an unemployment center. They showed you how to write a resume. They gave you a big book of companies that you could apply for. It was almost a joke. We would make jokes about it. But I was out of work for almost 2 years, and you see a different person in the mirror. We did the same thing to millions and millions of people in this country where their, not just their job, but their profession disappeared right out from under them, and we had no satisfactory way to give them an opportunity to recreate their lives. And it's not that hard. When you start looking at what we're going to have to do in the next 10 years, the next 20 years, to provide skills and really aggressively go after the skills. I remember, I ended up opening a bar. You have to do anything when you're out of work. But I opened a brew pub in 1988. I remember in 94 or 95, customers talking about, well, you know, the guys are losing their jobs in those factories across the Midwest. They can't adapt to the new economy. They can't manage computers. You go hang out with any of those people and look at how well they use a cell phone now. Right, and that is, not, if nothing, if not a powerful computer. Yeah. We need to be giving the skills that people need to get into the new economy now.
Can I ask you to be a bit more specific about that, and then I'll ask Governor Kasich to add his view too, because I wanted to ask about AI. It's a big new initiative at Brookings as well. We're concerned about it, and General Allen certainly is. There's a sort of spectrum between the people who are hugely enthusiastic about artificial intelligence. It will liberate us all from the ardors of work, and we'll all be free to do whatever we want, and those who are terrified by it because it will displace increasing numbers of middle-skill jobs, and AI is really going to be different from other forms of automation. Where are you on that spectrum of terrified to excited, and what specifically does it mean to upgrade the skills when it's so hard to know what skills will be needed in that
right.
world?
Well, you can't be...
I'm terrified at enthusiasm. First of all, just...
You're an enthusiast.
Okay.
But I'm very cautious for two things. One is... Change is occurring so rapidly, and all of our processes for decision-making, how do we make regulations and create a regulatory framework, they're all based on endless stakeholder investment of time, and you go around and around. We've got to get to a place where we can react much more rapidly to the changes that are taking place in things like AI. And you sit down and talk to someone like Elon Musk, and he'll say we're already so far behind, it's becoming impossible to do that kind of regulation. But we're on a path that we're going to the jobs we've been eliminating, and we will accelerate the elimination of more of those jobs are the grunt jobs, the jobs that really aren't very satisfying. And what we have to do is retrain a huge chunk of our population. And no one's going to get a free ride, right? Everyone's going to have to work hard at learning things. We're going to have to transform our community colleges into free centers of educational innovation. That's all going to have to happen very, very rapidly so that we don't suffer more of this. But I think the nationalism is the natural byproduct of despair and a feeling that you have no future and there's not, no matter what you do, the system's rigged against
and
you.
And it's self-perpetuating. Governor Kasich, your view. First of all,
got
enthusiast, terrifying.
This was worth coming. I needed one,
so
I got
brand
my
new.
Can today.
I just bought that.
Well, first of all, when John said something here that kind of hit me, I don't know if you heard it. When you look in the mirror after a while, you see a different person. I mean, I think one of the things that's unfortunately happened in our country is somehow we've been unwilling to the young people that are here to put ourselves somehow in our neighbor's shoes. Think about what he said. You know, you look in the mirror after a couple years and you see a different person. That's really, really hard for me. And we can't lose that notion that we are our brother's keeper. To me, part of this is faith with only two simple rules. Love God, love your neighbor. More than that, there's nothing else that really matters. In regard to this problem, I just went to... connected vehicle demonstration in our state. And so we have auto mechanics, right? But let me tell you what the story is. You got one camera up on one light pole, another one over here, and there's four of them. Okay, four of these cameras. One takes a picture of a car coming, sends a signal to this, it goes into a box that's right on the street corner, which sends a signal to the car. Now, somebody's got to put these cameras up there. Someone has to maintain the cameras. Someone has to build the box that the equipment is in. And somebody has to make sure that the that any of the mechanisms that are necessary to transmit this, the sensors, have to be placed and maintained. You don't need to go to MIT to do a lot of this. I mean, I don't know anything about coding, but I know we're now teaching coding in the fifth grade. It doesn't mean you have to be able to figure out how the trajectory of a rocket ship to the moon in order to engage in some of these activities. I'm going to suggest something here that our education system is just simply doesn't work. It doesn't work. We are not taking young people and putting them in a work environment, stirring up their passions, telling them what it is that they need to know. And I don't blame the teachers, but the system is broken. We are operating a school system based on a bunch of people working in the fields, and everybody learns the same way. And anytime you try to disrupt that system, I swear to you, it's easier to reform the Pentagon than it is the K-12 system. And neither of them, I don't think, are frankly reformable. I think that the K-12 education system, this needs to be disintermediated. And John mentioned the community college. The four-year schools, they continue the way they're doing. They're dead men walking. They are not. They charge too much. They are not giving people skills. College debt today, over $1 trillion. And yet the people who ring up this debt are not getting the skills they need to get work. And increasingly, we find moms and dads in a very difficult position because they have to support, the baby boomers have to start supporting their kids with subsidies so that they can have, so they can live. I mean, this is just unbelievable. And yet the system doesn't change. And all we do, Ruth, is say, oh, education, education. Well, what does that mean? So now you have my buddy, it's a commercial for him, I guess, but I don't mean it to be, and maybe someday I'll work with him, runs a thing called Udacity. And that is where the companies themselves begin online to train people at low cost for skills that companies need. But his skills are like highfalutin skills. We need to figure out a way in which we can actually get kids to learn what it is they need to learn, and also to teach them how to talk, how to react to one another like Mr. and Mrs. or General Allen, not John. I heard that today in his little room over there, okay? He's General Allen. Give him his due. Give him his title. What I'm saying is all these things matter. And I really believe that we are short. Because we can't reform this system, we continue to do what we do, what we do, what we do. It's like Afghanistan, over and over and over again, and we do what we do today because that's what we do. It's not acceptable. So can we take people and transform them into people that can manage the cameras, that can build the boxes, that can figure out how to do the things in this new world? Because you know what? The new world is going to give them a better job at a higher salary, because it's going to involve more of their brain. It's going to involve less back and less brawn and more brain. But we're not getting there because we're just too darn slow and a tsunami's coming our way. Okay. Have I given up hope? No, we're not giving it up. Hickenlooper and I are not going to give it up. We're the guys that we were willing to shake anything from top to bottom to get a result. But this is serious, serious stuff.
So first thing, a request for another pen so that I can retrieve my pen back here from Governor Kasich. Could someone give Governor Kasich a pen? Could you train your staff to give you a pen? That's a skill. Secondly, just to reassure everybody else in the room, I think it was me that said John Allen, so I'll admit that was me.
Yeah. Good.
There's a lot of junior staff out there right now, sort of terrified. Was that me? Was that me? Was that me? I got it. Let me just.
I don't want your pen. No way.
Hey, give me a pen, and you
probably
can have
a liberal pen.
Have my pen. This is a British pen, so it's
oh, who knows where the hell that's going?
So. So you're both telling a human capital story, an education and training, a skills story in response to the shock. One response to that would be, we've kind of heard this before. We've heard this around trade adjustment. We've heard it since the 90s. We've heard there's going to be changes, trade, AI, automation. But don't worry, we're going to help retrain you for this brave new world so you will benefit. And it feels like that's been on the record for quite a long time. And instead, what we're seeing now is people saying, that isn't going to happen. It hasn't worked. We need massive redistribution, maybe through tax credits, maybe even through a universal basic income of some kind. Or we need significantly more regulation of the labor market. higher minimum wages, maybe more power to unions again, because we've been waiting and waiting and waiting for the human capital story to deliver higher income growth for middle-class families. So it's not to say that you're wrong, but it is to say that we've heard this for a very long time. Why should we think it's different this time to hear it from you? Because it's not that different to the story we heard 20 years ago.
So first, just to finish the education part, because I agree everything that John said, we can make a huge impact on the education system and have kids ready to be in business and to learn skills more rapidly. We have the ability now, and kids, 25% of our kids aren't learning how to read by the end of third grade, and we promote them.
Yeah.
And we have the technology available now that we can identify that when they're in kindergarten. We can, for 80% of them, we can remediate that and fix it for, relatively speaking, small amount of cost, right? 20% per year of the kids, what you're normally using to spend on the education of that kid. That we don't do that is government malpractice. Same thing with multiplication, long division, fractions by the time you're in sixth grade. That stuff you have to have a real chance in this new life of skills. Now, in terms of redistributing wealth, I mean, if you really go out and talk across all the different income groups and different strata of society, it's relatively unpopular. There's a number of people that are very supportive of it. And certainly, increasing the minimum wage has a stronger sense. Mm-hmm. I look at it, for all this time, we've been disincentivizing labor. And one thing is we have this massive payroll tax. And I think it's worth considering looking at, and Bell and I were talking about this before, we're the last industrialized country that doesn't have a value-added tax, a VAT. Mm-hmm. And everyone say, well, we don't want another new tax. Okay, I get that. What if you did a swap where you just said, all right, we're going to get rid of that payroll tax and we're going to let that money go directly to the employees. They get it's like a way of raising much more easily everybody's wages, not just the minimum wage, but everybody's hourly wage. And then you look at that and replace it exactly evenly by a VAT. So that's one. And there are a number of things like that. We've also done regulations that have helped purposefully eliminate the middle class. And one of those things is middle managers. For years and years, there's a limit on how many hours you can work. If you make above a certain amount, you can work 50 hours, 60 hours, you don't have to get overtime. That number hasn't changed since, I think it was 1978. And it's still at $28,000. So if you're making over $28,000, you can be making $29,000 and you can be working 70 hours a week. That has been Shanghai. They used to raise that level every year. If we went back and inflation adjusted it where it is now, it should be at $62,000. So people should be working at making $62,000. Otherwise, they get paid overtime. That would dramatically transform, and that was a way that did transform and eliminate a large chunk of the middle class just over, incremental changes over time.
Governor Casey, you said growth is everything.
Just one thing here about the training. The reason why the training doesn't work is because nobody's interested in changing the training. And the reason why the K-12 isn't working is because nobody's interested in... Yeah. That's why you might need to have what I call this intermediation.
What do you mean by that?
Well, in K-12, the horse got replaced by the car, or the engine, steam engine, got replaced by the car. Things can come along that can completely disrupt. Because if you're just trying to reform and the system just does not want to reform, then you're going to have something that swoops in that offers a better answer. Now, I think part of this is the responsibility of employers to be engaged in the community. And the other thing is, if you really want to talk about where things get done, you got to be at the community level. You got to be right there at the block, and we ought to stop fighting about Trump this or Kavanaugh that or whatever, and we ought to start focusing more on what exists where we live. And little changes that we can bring in our block, in our community, in our school system can pay huge results. So if you really want to talk about education reform, if you really want to talk about job training and all that stuff, you got to get it where people are going to be hands-on, they're going to get their fingernails dirty, and we're going to go out there and we're going to grab somebody and we're going to get them moving in the right direction. We don't do that. We have, some kind of edict from Washington. Come on. They don't know... They're at the lunch, But that to me is what you need to do. I like a lot of John's suggestions. I do believe, however, not just in this world, but in all over the world. I've just talked to an economist about this. I couldn't get any astrologer on the phone, so I went with an economist. And there is a suggestion. I mean, really what we need to do is we need to give middle and low income people access to equities. If you really want it, here's what happens in the country. Rich people ride the market up. Other people don't have the resources to ride the market up. So the rich get richer and the middle and the poor get, there's a bigger gulf, or maybe not get poorer, but they're certainly not growing. So one man suggested to me today that we ought to be thinking about how they can use the taxes from sovereign wealth funds to create an opportunity for people to invest. We need to make sure that people who are middle and lower income can have access to a market, a dynamic market that can raise wealth. I mean, of course, you know, raise the minimum wage and all that, that's fine. But that's such much on the margin. You need a dynamic, dramatic effect in order to begin to change this. So to me, it's kind of a couple things. One, it's education in the real sense. I'll give you an example. Why don't kids just spend 3 days a week in school and the other 2 days not in a classroom? Why don't we do that? Try to go and push that through the D.C. public schools, okay? That's where kids are going to get real experience based on what they're excited about and what they can learn. My daughter worked at Pink. She learned why math and statistics are important. She loves fashion, but now she loves math. Because she understands that if you're going to be in fashion, you need to know how much to order and how to do it, and that's why she loves math now. It is not complicated. And all of you who are here today who have been successful had somebody or something that you related to when you were young that got you excited about what it is you were interested in. We need to have more of that. Then we need to think about the structural things. And when John's talking about structural changes, there shouldn't be anything off the table. Redistribution or socialism means one simple thing. That means that fewer people have more and everybody else has less. That's the way socialist systems work. It doesn't bring any wealth to the masses. The masses never taste any of the wealth. But there have to be some structural changes. And then finally, did you all see the New York Times? You probably didn't see it because you live in Washington. Yesterday in the New York Times.
Some people read it here.
Yeah. Did you see the picture in the New York Times? I think it was a 2-year-old girl who was on her way to deportation court.
Yeah.
Are we not upset about this? Yes. What the hell is happening in America where nobody is, they don't talk about it on television. How could they be putting a 2-year-old in a deportation court without, can't even speak English? Did you read that story?
Yes.
Now you want to be outraged? Where's the outrage? In our country. For this, John, did you see this thing? It's just completely crazy. It goes against everything I've ever learned as an American, that we would do that to people who are just trying to escape either death or addiction or gangs, violence, whatever it is. And somehow, we don't care. We better get back up on the horse again.
And who do you hold responsible for that?
All of us. All of us.
Tell us, each of you, tell us how you think we got to that point.
Well, why don't you
how did you get to that
point? Why
don't
you call somebody in charge and just tell them that this is not acceptable? Why don't you write your letter? Why don't you do something? Why don't you do something in your community for these people who are here, people who are immigrants? You know, we opened up an office in Ohio. You know what it is? By the way, if you don't like your immigrants here, send them all to Ohio. We want them all. We want every last one of them because they're productive, they're hardworking, okay? And we're making it as easy as we can. Look, I don't know what you can do or what your skill is, but the idea that I'm waiting on somebody else to come and fix the problems where I live is, it's like waiting for Godot. We have to... I've said enough.
But I think your offer was taken seriously and the passion was taken seriously. Let's talk about another area where I think you both have disagreements with the current administration, which is trade and trade policy. Governor Hickenlooper, I'll ask you to speak on this first. It's clear that there are a non-trivial number of Americans do feel that free trade has hurt them, and there is some economic evidence that some Americans have been hurt, at least in the short term, by free trade. That's now been highly politicized, turned into something we didn't think would happen, which has become a hugely political issue again. 2 weeks ago, you wrote a joint letter, the two of you, both governors, saying we cannot look backward and close off our markets. We must look forward and connect them in ways that benefit both our workers and the next generation. How do you think we got here on free trade, and how do you think we fix it? And in particular, answer your own question, how do we connect those trade trade connections to the well-being of the people who currently feel that free trade is not helping them.
Sure. And it gets back to where I started talking about how do you avoid leaving behind huge segments of the population, these workers, and the disintermediation, as you were describing, of schools happens with adults trying to relearn things as well. There's a guy in France, I'm sure a couple of people out here have run across this guy named Xavier Niel, the tech billionaire who bought a train station, turned it into this big startup center, and then he took an old schoolhouse. It's called, you can Google this, 42. It's the name of the school, just the number 42. It's a secret to the universe, according to the Hitchhiker's Guide. Yeah. But anyway, he lays it out, and capacity is 3,000 students. There's no teachers. So you walk into this old schoolhouse on three floors. There are about 2,500 giant screens, and people learn 21 different projects on how to learn coding. It's about a three-year program if you're working full-time at a job, or you can do it in maybe a year if you're working if you're on a student full-time. I went there on a Sunday night, and basically there's huge extra credit given for helping some other student. So when you're finishing sixth segment, it'll show you exactly who else has just finished the sixth segment, who else is just beginning the seventh, what computer they're on at that moment. We went on a Sunday night, and I met a guy who's probably 38 years old. He was worked for a trucking company in Marseille. He and three other workers who I didn't meet but were there, that they are the ones who load a tractor trailer. And you put in the stuff first, it comes out last. But you also have to balance the weight and do it. I mean, there's a certain amount of geography to it. And they realize that in 5 to 7 years, a robot's going to take over their job. So their company and the French government are training them. They've identified that this is a profession that's going to go out of business. And so this breakthrough, and we're talking about disintermediation, this is a way of training people in real time at an affordable cost that they're going to be the technicians of those robots. They're going to be the repair people for those robots. And here you want me to talk about being optimistic about the future. We have that capacity now.
So the answer on trade and automation is a human capital.
Well, and trade,
it's training smarter, faster.
Absolutely.
Right?
So that's the trading, and that's a key to making trade have less losers and make that loss less intense.
Right.
But in terms of trade, every trade agreement has winners and losers, right? And what happens is as the time progresses, the system manipulates it. So sometimes the losers lose more. Sometimes the winners get a lot more. But the self-interest that lobbies Washington, that lobbies Ottawa, lobbies Mexico City, are all really helping the winners win more.
Yeah.
And that's why trade agreements that go 25 years without being adjusted generally create some big losers. There's no question we should revisit it. But the notion that trade doesn't create wealth is totally misgotten. I mean, there's probably no better way, if we're really going to try to address income inequality, than figuring out responsible trade.
Yeah, not least globally. But there are losers. And Governor Kasich, in your state, there must be some people who have lost out from the free trade agreements. And some of that loss has been refracted through political processes.
Well, I mean, it's all about a dynamic and change. Look, we live in a global environment. You know, we hear about how we have this new great NAFTA deal, okay? If you think that the old NAFTA deal was bad and that all these jobs are going to be coming back, you don't check under your pillow tonight for the tooth fairy. This is not some new dynamic, incredible. You know why? Because the pressures of globalization, supply chains, the ability of people to do things more efficiently, more effectively, really matters. Now, I think that the best trade agreements are the ones where all sides have to lower the barriers. That's exactly what the international trade agreement is all about, lower barriers, not higher barriers. And there's one other element of trade that's important, and we don't want to forget these folks, and I agree with John. We need to, but again, we're back to having human beings really care about other human beings and say, we're going to get you, we're going to lift you, we're going to help you. And it has to happen where we live more than it is from Washington there. It has to happen locally. So the more they can send whatever funds they have, with a trillion-dollar debt, $21 trillion debt, but the more they can get the funds to where we are and get it as local as possible, the better off we're going to be. But there's another element to trade that we sometimes forget, and let's just take the Pacific Partnership that we walked away from. there's all these little countries out there that live in the shadow of China. Now, I don't subscribe to China, their rules and their value system. But when we walk away, the Chinese shadow falls on these countries. And we're now starting to get alarmed about the influence of China all over the globe, including in South America, most particularly. So the question gets to be, if we don't trade, then we don't talk. And if we don't talk, we don't have the relationships. There's a geopolitical element to trade that the general will tell you that the more we trade, the more we know somebody, the better off we're going to be in the long run. But there isn't any question that we just can't walk away from people who do lose their work. But to say we're going to keep your job isn't going to work anyway. So consumers pay less. The quality is better. And how did we get here on trade? Because those who are free traders did not make the case for trade, and some of them defended trade deals that didn't make any sense, I suppose. So free trade always has to be defended. We need to tell people, not even defended, but we need to be arguing forcefully for it and what it brings to consumers, families, and the ability to progress as humanity, frankly.
Let me finish before going to the audience, so please be ready with your questions. And now I guess there are mics around, so the mics are in the back corners. Let me finish with a question on politics. And it feels as if many of the proposals that you've both been articulating would lie in the sort of middle ground. Right? You're both, I think, against the populism that you're seeing on some of the right, against some of the populism we're seeing on the left. These are broadly sort of middle ground policies, but we don't really have a middle ground politics right now. So the question is, do we need a stronger middle ground in our politics in order to have policies to help the middle class? And if so, how can we get to there from here, given the polarization that both of you have written and spoken about so much? Can you see a path from where we are now to more of a middle ground politics to help the American middle class? Governor Hickenlooper.
I would say that the label itself is a little bit misleading. Middle ground implies that you're somehow
like a compromise,
sacrificing something you believe in.
Yeah.
And so within the Democratic Party, and I'll let Governor Kasich talk about the Johnson expert on the Republican Party at this point. I think within our party, you know, I've been saying, an old friend of mine sent me a clipping I wrote to a newspaper in Middletown, Connecticut in 1978 saying, in the end, I think healthcare, some level of healthcare should be a right, not a privilege. So that's informed. I've held that view my whole life. You can argue about how much or how little. But to get into big fights on, you know, we need Medicare for all, or we need a single payer system, or we, you know, some variation that gets us there, I don't think that's the key there, and it's not moderate, is saying that everyone should have some level of healthcare, and we might disagree about that.
Right.
I think the issues come back down to, I think compromise is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. It's what this country used as a fuel for growth. You would find ways to compromise with somebody you directly disagreed with. But I think right now, anytime you compromise, you're seen as a victim in some way, or a traitor, that
or
you
cheap.
Have manipulated your values. But you know, whether you're talking about healthcare, whether you're talking about education, whether you're talking about any of these things, when you get back to the values that we believe that everybody ought to have the opportunity to create their own version of the American dream,
yeah.
Everybody believes in that. And I don't think that's moderate. I think that is the way the country was intended, and in a funny way now is more rare.
Right.
Rather, moderate implies it's kind of this large number of people.
So deeper rather than moderate or
deeper,
whatever.
That's
actually,
fair.
Bell's book is built around values of work, family, and education. And she starts from there and builds the policy agenda up from those values, which she believes to be shared in exactly the same way you do, Governor. Governor Kasich.
Well, the real trick is to figure out how the middle's not boring. I tell you why I say it. Because I said some things here that are, you know, not big deal, provocative or whatever, it will get attention. If we just sat here and talked about, well, you know, this academic stuff, no one would care. I mean, we have this tendency today to give attention to that person that screams the loudest. I mean, I went through presidential debates, and the whole key was, well, how can you say something so incendiary that they are forced to cover it the next day? And by the way, when you do that, you will say that you did a great job. So here I am on a Republican debate stage saying we should not rip up the Iran deal. We should be concerned about the minimum wage. I believe we should expand Medicaid.
I wonder why, but I did finish second, you know. And I did win Manhattan, and some say even Trump Tower. But I think, John, I think the key is to start with principles. So John and I have, you wouldn't believe how many governors we couldn't get to work with us. I mean, it's really, you know, people say, oh, they count on the governors, you know. Yeah, really? Like on health care, we're never going through the whole repeal of Obamacare. Mm. There were some things that we established as principles. Anybody that has a pre-existing condition should be able to get health care. Who doesn't agree with that? That, you know, we can't have a whole bunch of people that have no health insurance. Okay, forget the Obamacare, is it too rich of a structure, is it not? What are the principles that we agree upon? It's just like, John, I don't know how many of these things we've done together, because we agree on the principles. And the details is what you hammer out over time. Right now, I find that, you know, we're not talking about the principles, so therefore, you can't hammer out the solution. So one of the things I suggested the other day on a Supreme Court appointment, if I were president, I would have called Joe Manchin, I would have called the guy over in Delaware, my friend Tom Carper, I would have called Hickenlooper, and I'd say, hey, can you come? Maybe hide camp, I don't know. I'd say, let's have a little meeting. Now, we're going to have a conservative judge. I mean, you know that because I'm the Republican president, I'm conservative. We're going to have a conservative. Who's okay with you? Right? Let's go through the process. Who's okay? So the other day, I did something on guns. I created this group, and I said, you have to be a Second Amendment supporter. If you want to repeal the Second Amendment, you're not going to be in the group. But if you agree that you're for a Second Amendment, okay, great. Now let's figure out what the limits of it are. And we got people who would never were in a room together, in a room, figuring out, okay, what is it that we can do and what we can't do? And what are the principles? So I think in order to get this done, what would be a principle today? America has too much debt. It does. Now let's wrestle to the ground what we do about it. You know, that we have to have a health care system that doesn't have massive loss of health care. And by the way, I think we can all agree, what can we sit down and discuss about these incredible rising costs of pharmaceuticals? I mean, there are ways in which we could think about this, but if you start with common principles, then I think you can build it out. But for all of us, like John and I, we have to figure out, really, how to make the middle interesting and not the middle boring. And one last thing on that front, okay? So here's a great story. You hear about this 5-year-old girl? I called this little girl and her mother. She lives, I think, in Illinois, yeah. So her name is Flo. Her full name is Florence. So she's reading about this hurricane. And she's like, oh, my God, this hurricane. Mom, we better get some bandages and things for people and send it to them. It's a cool story. So then mother goes, yeah, that's a great idea, Flo. So the father takes a picture of this little girl, and you know how they have the hurricane maps and it shows the storm moving? Well, Florence's face was put on the map, and she took this and hitched it to her wagon, and her 3-year-old brother pulled the wagon through the neighborhood, and they collected so much stuff that their garage is bursting with all the supplies that they're now about to send to North Carolina. So when you start the story, the ravaging of a hurricane, ugly, the hero who intervenes, Flo, and the top of the mountain, which is something that makes us all feel good. We've got to have better narratives. We've got to tell a better story so that people can say, yeah, I don't have to live on the extremes and tear people down. I can get excited about something that's really pretty interesting and pretty good. That's kind of the way I look at it.
Find a way to scale up Flo as well. That's the other thing.
How about Flo?
Flo would be
good. By the way, when I called her, she did come to the phone. She said, I got so much attention.
Yeah, right in the middle here, there. Lady there, yeah. There, yeah. And then is there another mic out here somewhere? No, it's this one mic, okay.
Oh, sorry,
the lady behind you.
Oh, behind.
Yeah.
Thank you. My name is Samira Daniels. I was intrigued with your point about the K-12 education. And I wanted to sort of flip that and suggest that decision-making in the federal government and the state level is not going to improve until we take evidence-based policy-making much more seriously. And there are some think tanks that have been pursuing this. And I wondered what you thought about that, because, you know, most of the decision-making is political interest-based. So
good. Thank you for making it a question as well. If everyone could do that, or at the very least have your tone of voice rising towards the end of the sentence. Let's go to the gentleman.
Oh, she wanted. I think she wanted an answer to that.
Yeah, we're going to do take a couple. I'm sorry.
Let's just take that. We'll be real short. Look, I think the problem is this. It's at the school board level. Too many times people get on the school board and then they want to go to the basketball games and they get escorted into the gym and they have a nice court, middle of the court, and they're with their spouse. They're like, isn't this cold? And I'm important. I'm on the school board. And there's a tendency to forget what you're there for. So you're there to go along and get along, not to disrupt. We need to disrupt the system because our children are the ones that are at risk. And it's the local schools, the local superintendents, all of that. It's so frustrating to me, but John, what do you think?
And if you could say something about the evidence point, too, because I think that's a very strong. We're promised evidence-based policymaking, but we get policy-based evidence-making quite a lot of the time, especially in education.
No, so you're exactly
not from
right.
your states, of course, but and that's under threat, I think, that whole idea of evidence-based policy.
We push back, just in terms of schools, and I think that's what I agree completely with what John said. We've got a big apprenticeship program right now that allows kids to get into, when they're 17, they can go work for a company. It's not just a plumber or electrician. They can work for a bank, insurance company, you name it. We're now in the third year of the pilot. We've got about 500 kids. So the first year they work 2 days, go back to a community college for 3 days. Second year they work 3 days. Third year they work 4 days. At the end of 3 years, they're living at home. They probably have $12,000 or $15,000. They have a year's worth of college credit if they choose to pursue it. But it's that kind of, they're learning how to make those decisions. In terms of evidence-based decision-making throughout government, we did with the Buffett Foundation supported us with $5 million a year for about 6 years, a little over 6 years, where we provided long-acting reversible contraception to any young woman who wanted, regardless of income level. If you had decent income, you'd pay a small amount of money. And we just for the social conservatives out there, if a teenager came in, we said, you're too young to have sex. But don't compound one bad decision with a second. And we provided IUDs, Norplants, things where someone in a chaotic life didn't have to remember exactly which day they took a pill. But we reduced, I think by the end of this year, we will have reduced teenage pregnancy by 60% and teenage abortion by 70%.
But the challenge was we
could not get funding through our General Assembly because the facts were less important than the partisan divide over family value. Family planning having value. So that's, I think, your question extends to that kind of an arena.
Just to make sure that the people are going to listen to this. Teachers need to be paid more. They need to be respected. Okay, it's all about money and all that. But the deal is that there's nobody that I'm going to call the bad person in this. It's the system itself. No, it's the system itself that's failing us. The structure fails us. Nobody in the Pentagon wants to buy a weapon system that has a huge cost overrun. It's the system that drives us to the wrong place. Now, there are some schools, and John has been a leader on all this stuff with the training people. I mean, he's been out in front of everybody, and as far as I'm concerned. The key, though, is to release our kids to the goodness of the community and get the businesses and everybody together. And I'd start these, but we're starting these programs now in the first grade. We want to tell kids, what's a weatherman do? What's a policeman do? What's a teacher do? Get them excited. Get them out there. But let's say we're all in this together, and demonizing anybody in that system does not work. We just have to realize what the evidence is and get them out of that place into something else.
There are now a number of states following Colorado's lead on that, including North Carolina, Delaware, et cetera. Now, the gentleman there,
Hi, I'm David Amanis. I actually worked on Governor Kasich's campaign last year, so this brought back good memories.
Well, you didn't do that, great.
No, I have a question. Right. Yeah, sorry.
I wouldn't be bragging about
how
that.
How did he become so amazing?
Yeah, Eric Looper, he says you shouldn't be bragging about that.
What do you all think of a universal job guarantee?
sorry. Say again.
Universal job guarantee. What do you all think?
I just still didn't get it.
A universal job guarantee.
Oh, no, job guarantee. Very different thing. Universal job guarantee gaining a lot of traction, as you'll know, on the Democrat side. There's a debate, should we just give people money, or should we make sure that everybody can get a job? And that it's one thing to say we're going to have conditionality and so on for people who can't get a job, so we deal with that by saying everyone can get a job, and effectively it makes the government the employer of last resort, if not directly, then by funding it. Governor Hickenlooper.
So I shy away from that just because we're not far enough in the evolutionary curve of all these jobs supposedly disappearing, which I think they're going to change, but I think there are going to be so many new jobs coming.
I am inclined towards incentives to make sure that people hire more. You know, getting rid of the payroll taxes, payroll wages, and putting them into a VAT or some other version of a tax-neutral solution provides a dramatic incentive for people to hire more people. It takes some of that penalty off.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to squeeze one more in.
Bernie, I haven't studied that yet.
I'm going to squeeze one more question in. I'm going to give it to Alice Rivlin right here on the front row.
Alice Rivlin, give her a round of applause. She's the best.
Thank you. Well, I'm a big fan of both of yours and of what you're doing together. But I want to ask you about the role of states, and particularly in education, because you've talked a lot about K through 12. The federal government doesn't really do much there. They meddle a little bit, but they don't have a lot big role. And even in higher education, that's basically a state thing. So as governors, what has been holding you back from doing some of the things in Colorado, in Ohio, that you've been talking about?
Great question. Governor Kasich.
Well, I mean, we're doing a lot of things. In fact, if a school district fails like 2 or 3 years in a row, we can take over the school district and appoint somebody to fix it. We're doing it in Youngstown now. You know about the Cleveland reform. Look, one of the things I want to, there are two things I wanted to do in my legislature. The first one is every single school board should have a non-elected business person on the board to help them with curriculum. I couldn't pass it. Okay, the other one was I wanted every teacher to be, whenever they go to renew their contract, to be able to go out and spend, you know, a few days with a business to see what's happening in the business world. I couldn't pass it. You see, what happens is this system, you know, it's like asking me, it's like asking, okay, why did we have, you know, $500 hammers in the Pentagon? Well, because we couldn't get enough votes to fix it. Well, we did. But, I mean, I'm just saying to you, if you can't, when the system shoots back at you and they go around and they blunt you, then it's hard. But we've made tremendous gains in many different areas in education, but simply not. And many of the schools are doing what we're suggesting. Community colleges now working with schools. It's a coalition of the willing. I just wish there were more willing. And it's on all of us, and not just me, but it's on the community college leaders. It's on the business leaders in the community. So what I was saying earlier, what can you do? What can you do to make a change? Well, go talk to the schools about it. You're worried about the future? Talk to the schools about, talk to the superintendent. What are you doing to prepare these kids for the changing economic environment? Don't leave it to me. What are you doing about this, Alice? I mean, what are you doing? I mean, why are you asking me? What have you done? Make an accounting of yourself. We need to hear from you.
Yeah.
No, you see what I'm saying. It's hard because the legislature is political, and they're worried about somebody's going to be mad at them.
But once Alice has been governor for 2 terms, which is, I'm sure, going to happen, Governor Heckenlieber, you've got a particular challenge because it's highly decentralized in Colorado.
We are. The local municipalities and counties have their own. We have 174 school districts, many of them very small. It is a challenge, but you can incentivize them. You can't dictate to them, and you can provide them models of things that work. And so the last 10 years, we've had a guy named Tom Boasberg. Actually, our U.S. Senator, Michael Bennett, was the superintendent for the first 3 years, and then the last 10 years, Tom Boasberg has been there. But they have innovative schools, these failed schools that were going to be shut down, and the teachers' union agreed to work with the principal, allow him to control schedule. So they have a quarter of their teachers come in an hour early and leave an hour early. A quarter of the teachers come in an hour late but leave an hour late. So they went from 6.5 hours a day to 8 hours a day of school time. And then they paid everyone a little bit more money, and they went from 186 days of school to 205. So longer school day, longer school year. And they took one of the worst middle schools in the state, and they turned it into one of the top 5 middle schools. And I know this for a fact because my son went there just after they'd done these changes, and it was miraculous that all these kids that come from lower-income, chaotic homes where they have a hard time doing their homework, they're doing their homework at school in study halls before the beginning and the end of school. That kind of change when you provide – so now we've got these things – all over the state. Now, I can't mandate it yet, but I feel certain that in 3 or 4 years, we'll have the vast majority of middle schools will be on this type of a model. And, you know, finding other ways where you can integrate business leaders with the teachers, just motivate and incentivize the schools that do bring business personnel into the schools to help them. I mean, most teachers, I mean, Most principals were very good teachers, and they got promoted to be principals. Yeah. They're not necessarily good principals. They don't know how to manage a big enterprise. They don't aren't as good with budgets. But you give them a little bit of support, and they can get better quickly.
Let me tell you the limits of power, and this can be depressing. I was talking about the gun control stuff. So one of the things we came up with was a red flag law that I think Hickenlooper got enacted in Colorado. Different state, different group, different sense of, but here's the thing. If you know of somebody in your family or in the workplace who's unstable and poses a danger to themselves or to others, that you can go to a judge, and if a judge rules that you're right, that person's gun is taken away until they are stabilized. I can't not pass it. I cannot pass it. Now, would I give up? Am I pessimistic? Do I not believe in the system? No, I don't. It's going to take time. And the frustrating thing of being a leader is you'd like to snap your fingers and get everything done. But, you know, maybe it's good that you have to work, you have to strive, you have to push. And but there's limits to our ability to persuade. There's limits of our ability to really be fantastic. And you know what? Maybe that's a good thing in the end. It brings about a greater sense of humility.
And we didn't get it done either. We, at the last minute, the votes were blocked.
You know, and it's just, you think about that, how frustrating it is. But that, look, folks, the most important message I want to give you is this. You know, there was an article, David Brooks wrote about it today. I read about it in the plane today, about the community in South Carolina. It's actually started in Cincinnati, where we look evidence-based, we look at a problem, okay, whether the problem is homelessness, whether the problem is drugs, whether the, we got to do it there. Hmm. I suggested to Arne Duncan in Chicago, get the police, get the community activists, get the university people, get everybody in a room and figure out a strategy to deal with the gang problem and then move and get, run over the politicians. We have to do these things. Remember, what is that thing? Think globally, act locally. We have got to get back to believing that we are the heart and soul and the flame of America and not somebody who's elected. We should think about that.
I have to take the opportunity to finish with a quote from a philosopher, Jerry Cohen, who says, fairness is made in the thick of daily life. In the thick of daily life rather than in structures. But we do have to bring it to a close. I'd like to thank all of you for attending this event, which may come to be seen as a dress rehearsal for a future presidential debate. It may be an early campaign stop on an exciting bipartisan ticket. Either way, it's been really thrilling to have both of you here. Thank you, Governor Kasich and Governor Hickenlooper. Next up, we're going to get a summary of the book we are launching today, Bell Sawhill's book, The Forgotten Americans, which speaks to many of the policy issues that we've just been hearing about from the governors. So Bell's going to give a summary of the book, and then we're going to turn to our expert panel for responses. So over to Bell Sawhill.
Thank you, Richard. And I found that wonderfully inspiring to hear two governors from two different parties having such a constructive and civil discussion about some real questions. So I am going to dive right into my telling you about my book. It seems I'm not an economist after all. I'm an astrologer. So you can take everything I say with a grain of salt for that reason. Why did I write it? Well, I basically woke up on November 9th, 2016 in shock. I think many people were surprised about the outcome of the election, but I was really stunned. And so then I began reading about all of the reasons why we had this outcome, and there was speculation about, well, it was Russia, or it was Comey, or it was that people didn't like Hillary, or she didn't run the best campaign. But I think in the end, the most important reason was because people really were frustrated and they wanted change. And they didn't want incremental change. They wanted big change. They wanted some China broken. I think they were right to be frustrated. We have got really serious problems in this country. And They've gone unaddressed for far too long. So that has created this pent-up demand for some serious movement in a new direction. So I view the election as a kind of wake-up call to try even harder to do something about the forgotten Americans. I'll come to them in a minute. But in a way that fits these trying times and the values of the electorate. I thought this conversation about first principles, get agreement on that, was really important. Let's begin with the problem. Let's see. Do have some slides here. And I think the problem, the big problem, as you all know, I don't have to tell you, is that we're very divided as a country. We're not just divided economically. We're divided politically and culturally as well. And I think the reason it's important to talk about all three and not just about the economics is because I think any solution, including on the economic divisions, is going to have to be very sensitive to where we are culturally and politically. I no longer think we can treat these issues in separate silos. So what to do? On economics, I focus on work. That means jobs and wages. Why do I focus on that? First of all, I think it's a core American value. We believe very strongly in the U.S. in work. Second, the forgotten Americans, because I've gone out and talked to them, I'll tell you in a minute, it's what they want for themselves. You know, if you ask them, they say, really, jobs and wages is what they care about. And finally, I think work provides more than just income. It provides people with a sense of dignity and self-respect and being connected and contributing. On culture, I'm less optimistic. There isn't a lot that we can do. We've got huge divisions on how people feel about things like abortion, guns, immigration, religion, and so forth. But I'm going to suggest at least two ways that we might at least mitigate the cultural divide. One is to focus again heavily on basic values that we can all agree to, the principles again. And the second is to promote and encourage universal national service. And I'll come back to that. Politically, one way to characterize my book is that it's an attempt, as Richard said, to move to the center, to marry red state values about education, about work, and about family to blue state policies that would actually help people in practical ways to achieve their own goals in each of those areas. Moving to the center would furthermore, I think, recognize, and this is very clear to me, that the electorate is a lot more moderate than the activist wings of both parties. We don't hear about that enough. Given hyperpolarization, we may also want, as the governor said, to rely more on local and state governments, more on local community efforts, more on individuals and NGOs to improve people's lives. Now, I don't want to go quite as far as I felt they were going to think that that's all it's going to take, but I do think there's something to that. Simultaneously, we do need to reform our political institutions. I'm not going to have time to talk about them today. I'm hoping that my colleague Elaine might, but we've got to worry about dark money. We've got to worry about voting and gerrymandering and that whole list of political problems. Now, I call my book The Forgotten Americans because that's what Trump called them, and they have indeed been left behind, and many of them supported him. So who are they? Well, there's no one really right definition. But in my book, I first say, well, there are people that don't have four-year college degrees. I'm not too worried about them. Secondly, they are people who are in the bottom half of the income distribution. And so I'm taking out people who are doing just fine despite having the credential. And that leaves us about 38% of the working age population. When we look at their racial breakdown, a little more than half of them are white, and the rest are minority groups of various types. I think that we now can be ready to turn to their economic problems. And this slide basically tells you what is in about three chapters of my book. And I've just summarized it here because I think these trends are well known. Upward mobility is declining. Inequality is at unprecedented levels. Wages have stagnated, especially for the less educated. And labor force attachment is declining, especially among men. All of these problems were exacerbated by the recession in 2008, but they've been around for far longer than that. I would just stress that the problems are serious and that they have left a lot of people behind and that inequality is at virtually unprecedented levels. Now, although I'm focusing on economics, I don't want to leave the impression that what's been happening recently is just an economic story. It's also a story about culture. And when Government Kasich said it's some of both economics and culture, I agree with that. I see Bill Galston back there, and I think he's written a book that really gets at a lot of this. Some of you may have read these two specific books. They do an excellent job of describing the cultural issues affecting just one subgroup of the forgotten Americans, although it's a big subgroup, and that is white, what's usually called the white working class. Now, why have these two authors and also myself spent so much time giving some attention to this group? And I think the central reason is because they voted overwhelmingly for Trump. 67% of them voted for Trump, only 28% for Clinton. So if we want to understand the populist streak in our politics right now, we have to understand this group. They feel disrespected. They don't like immigrants. They don't like trade. They think it's destroying their jobs. And they are not happy about all the focus on the rights of women and minorities and the LGBTQ community. Now, it'd be easy to call them a bunch of deplorables, but as Hillary Clinton learned, that would be a mistake. They are a large and diverse group. Not all of them are nativists, misogynists, or racists. In fact, the data show that a significant number of them voted for Trump voted for Obama before they voted for Trump. And the swing voters in this group, I think, are pretty focused on economic issues, not some of these more divisive cultural ones. So one lesson I drew from reading this kind of literature is that it's a good idea to get out and actually talk to people, because that's what these authors did. And so I decided to do the same thing myself. And I hired a firm and went to three communities, Syracuse, New York, Greensboro, North Carolina, and St. Louis, Missouri. And I talked to the forgotten Americans, defined in exactly the same way as I define them in my book. This is what I learned from listening to them. This is not what I learned from listening to them. This is the publication that talks about what I learned from listening to them that is just being released today. Mark, thank you. These are some of the takeaways from listening to these groups. First of all, they really do understand something that the governors were talking about, that people do need to be better skilled than they are right now if they want to be able to fit into today's labor market. But they're very skeptical of college. You know, as one person said, college, 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 you know, kind of very dismissively. And they see young people coming in with college degrees, and they don't think they really know that much, and they don't see them being all that productive as a result. The other thing they then say is it's not finding a job that's hard. Now, that may reflect where we are right now economically. It's the wages. and to some extent the benefits. There are plenty of low-wage jobs out there, but that's not what this group aspires to. They're very big on the idea of personal responsibility. They would not agree with what I hear from a lot of my liberal friends about it's the structure of the system that's systematically making it impossible for them to get ahead. They don't think that at all. They want to be self-supporting. And they really feel not just underpaid, but also underappreciated, especially by their employers. This is an issue about respect and about feeling as like you're part of a team, as well as your wage or your income level. So let's move on then to this last point on this slide, which is they are enormously cynical about government. They think government doesn't work. They basically think it's a joke. I can't tell you how strongly they say that. And in case you think this is just a small sample, and it is a small sample, and it's not necessarily representative, here's the Pew data on trust in government, which is way down and is now around 20% and is even lower for some parts of the government, especially the part here in Washington. Now, let me turn next to what we might do about the economic grievances of the forgotten Americans, focusing on jobs and wages. I think the first thing we really need to do is to maintain full employment. I credit Jared Bernstein for having made me so aware of how much difference that makes to this particular group. Unlike those of us who have professional jobs, this group is very much affected by whether or not the economy is at full employment or not. Assuming we can maintain full employment, not easy, then the next point is that there are going to be lots of people who can't get jobs because they don't have the right qualifications or skills or because they live in the wrong places. And the governor's talked about that. And I think the solution to that is the one that they emphasize. We really need a serious effort to retrain and help people relocate. Next thing is, I think we do need a bold and very direct way that would boost take-home pay. I liked Governor Hickenlooper's ideas about this. I have a somewhat similar one, which is that we would give a tax credit to everyone whose earnings are below about $40,000 a year, and that tax credit would offset their payroll taxes and bump up their take-home pay. I call it just a worker tax credit. It's similar to the EITC, but simpler, less error-prone, more marriage-friendly, and more expandable to scale. I also think it would be politically popular. Harvard professor David Elwood used to say, if you work, you shouldn't be poor. That's a value statement. It resonated. President Clinton liked it so much that in the administration that he and I both served in, we actually expanded the EITC. I'm looking at Alice because she helped with that too. So that it was true that you would not be poor if you worked full time. A worker tax credit would not only put more income in people's pockets, I think it would send a signal that government is now on your side. It would be a tax cut, essentially, for the bottom ranks, but tied to the value and dignity of work, and not a tax cut once more for the wealthy. Now, it would be very expensive. I want to be open about that. Something like $1 trillion over a decade. How would we pay for it? I think the best way would be by taxing unearned wealth or very large estates. I discovered in the process of doing my research that the estate tax is actually a kind of a goose that lays a golden egg. And if we could just take the estate tax back to the parameters it had in about 2000, we could raise almost enough money to pay for my worker tax credit for everybody earning less than $40,000 a year. But as you know, right now, nobody pays a penny of estate tax unless they have more than $22 million per couple. Finally, because I think government can't be the only solution here, or perhaps even the major solution, given all of the distrust we've talked about, and the fact that all the growth in inequality, by the way, is due to the fact that market incomes are more unequal than they used to. It doesn't have anything to do with our tax and transfer system. So one way to think about this is we have to then go and look at the income that is earned in the private sector. 85% of jobs and income are in that sector. And I think with a small nudge from the tax system, we could change the way corporations treat their workers. We used to have unions to do that, but they've been seriously weakened. If they can be resurrected, I'm for that, but I'm dubious it's going to happen anytime soon. In the meantime, what I argue for is a more inclusive form of capitalism in which all stakeholders, especially workers, benefit when the economy is doing well. And I think with the right tax incentives, we could nudge American businesses back into training their workers. The amount of corporate training has gone down. And also in sharing success with their workers through profit sharing or through employee ownership. There are companies that do that now. Almost everyone has heard of Patagonia or Ben & Jerry's, but many of you may not be aware that even the big three auto companies, as well as a lot of the airlines industry, is doing this kind of profit sharing as well. Now, a lot of people, including me as an economist, worry that businesses aren't going to be competitive if they don't stay religiously focused on the bottom line, and I get that argument. But I did a lot of research on this, and frankly, I was surprised. It suggests that there is little, if any, trade-off within reason between treating your workers well and making a profit. Obviously, corporate America has to balance the interests of shareholders and those of workers, but all of the evidence suggests that right now they are overly focused on their shareholders and their quarterly profits. The new CEO of GE was quoted in the Wall Street Journal yesterday that we get hired and paid a lot because we are responsible for thinking more long-term than anybody else that works for the company. But if we miss two of our quarterly profits targets, we're going to get fired. And he was kind of explaining the dilemma we face right now. I think this is all about recognizing that operating a business is a team sport, and it would be like providing everyone, not just the top executives, the equivalent of a performance-based stock option when companies were doing well, and it might even boost flagging rates of productivity growth. Finally, to address our cultural discontents, our tribalism, I propose to expand or even make universal the idea of national service. President Kennedy famously said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Under my version of national service, every young person would be expected to provide a year of service, either military or civilian. There are older retired individuals who might want to participate as well. I add a new twist to this somewhat old idea by also suggesting that we ask American families all across the country to open their homes and host a young person during their year of service. My focus group participants, by the way, in the three cities I went to, they loved this idea when I talked about it. They really saw it as a way to reduce cultural gaps and help young people learn new skills while providing needed services at the community level and renewing a shared sense of identity and pride in country. This idea has had bipartisan support in the past, but right now our current program is small and very underfunded. So let me conclude. I have suggested a set of ideas that I believe have some merit, but if my book does nothing but catalyze a better discussion about what we might do for the forgotten Americans, I will be happy. And I'm really looking forward to getting reactions from the terrific panel that is now going to talk some more about all of these issues. And I want to welcome them up to the stage, and especially our moderator, Ruth Marcus from The Washington Post.
Hi, we're short on time, so I'm going to be super efficient here and start to talk while everybody's getting seated. I'm Ruth Marcus from The Washington Post, and I am neither an economist nor an astrologer, something even worse, I'm a journalist, which means my prognostications are even less likely to be taken seriously, but that's okay. I love coming to Brookings because it's a respite for me from the world of incessant tweets and hyper-partisanship. So being at Brookings in the world of ideas and being at Brookings in with two of the most thoughtful and bipartisan governors around, for me is like the journalistic equivalent of a spa day. So thank you. Thank you very much to Brookings. I appreciate that. But I also want to say, we've spent so little time really recently. We've spent so much time fighting, and we've spent so little time talking about policy changes that could actually address the needs of these forgotten Americans. I think I need to start with a more challenging question than I intended to start with, and I'm going to direct my question, I think, first to Bill Kristol and then to Elaine Kmark, which is this. Is our problem that we have a paucity of the right policy ideas, or is our problem that we just have a fundamentally broken political system that is incapable of dealing with even the smartest of ideas out there? Bill, that's a nice one for you. Great. Take it away.
As the person who knows the least on this panel, I get to go first, I guess. I mean, both, obviously. And we have good policy ideas, but let's put it this way. If you came down from Mars and someone said, huge globalization, 20 years, really, I think more in scale, in quantity, and maybe even qualitatively different than previous ways of globalization, you know, a billion workers coming into the U.S., to the world trading system, et cetera, and breakthroughs in automation, obviously, especially in communications technology, that, again, I was a skeptic that it was that transformative, but I now think it's a pretty big deal, maybe industrial revolution size deal. And then you, just those two, sort of more on the economic front, then throw in a huge amount of cultural and social change. Those are hard to deal with. Leave aside even the cultural stuff. Just the it's not like it's so easy to know exactly how to help lower, less well-educated people's wages if you're introducing a huge number of low-wage but pretty good workers into the global trading system. You could get rid of the global trading system and the free movement of capital, which would have huge costs in other ways. I think the policy ideas are good, but the problems are probably of a higher scale or bigger magnitude, greater magnitude than maybe the equivalent problems were in 1960 when the equivalent good ideas were developed, which led to various social insurance programs or EITC and 20, 30 years later, and so forth. Having said that, it's very clear the political system is broken. It magnifies divisions instead of moderating them. Political parties is the, I'll just say a word on this, is the easiest instance because I happen to vaguely look for 10 minutes at the sort of, or look, I didn't really look at the political science literature. I looked at accounts of the political science literature on parties, and the absolutely traditional account of parties, which is mostly correct, is they agree, bring interest groups together, force force them to compromise within parties, and in government force them to compromise between parties. And this is a way in which a huge, diverse, fractious society, one can get some progress and some consensus. It's very clear now that the party system, combined with the way Congress works, especially at the federal level, exacerbates divisions, leads to hyperpolarization and hyperpartisanship, not the opposite. Some of that may just be things that we don't quite control either, socioeconomic sorting and so forth, but some of it is just due to the particular ways some of our institutions work. I do think the political reform agenda, the right responses to automation and globalization, that's complicated and difficult and challenging. Fixing the political problems, the aspects of the system that are just making things worse, that should in principle be more doable, I think.
Okay, so Elaine, is it?
Yeah,
is it more doable?
I think it's more doable. I want to focus in on something that Belle brought up. And Ruth, I want to tell you that we do massages and facials upstairs.
I knew that. Okay. I knew there was a secret space.
You knew there was a secret space.
Confirming everyone's image of Brookings out there in America.
I want to focus on a subset of the political problem, one that I'm very familiar with, which Belle mentioned and showed this graph of trust in government. Part of the problem is that there's been the zeitgeist says that the government does everything wrong. The fact couldn't be further from the truth. There are millions of people every month who get their Social Security check. There are millions of people every month whose medical bills get paid by Medicare. The government is actually working. And if you take that trust number and break it apart and you ask people, how do you like Medicare? They love Medicare. Ask people how they love how they like Social Security. They love Social Security. Ask people how they love the United States military. They love it. Ask people how you love the post office, how they like the post office. They like the post office, okay? So this trust in government is a weird thing, which we've spent a lot of time breaking down in a project I did at the Kennedy School some years ago. And what it boils down to is there is some sense that what they do in Washington, we don't quite understand. And the way I've always explained it to my students is Washington is a great big ATM machine. You just go like this, and money goes. And where does it go? It goes to the states and to the localities. Now, what happens every time we have a government shutdown is people get it. They say, oh, all this government that I do like, it comes from Washington. What a surprise. And then, of course, they quickly forget because everybody spends all their time criticizing Washington. So I think we've got a big problem here in looking at the system and at the government and convincing Americans that actually, you know what, you're getting pretty damn good value for your dollar.
I'm sorry, are you saying that what we have here is a messaging failure?
I think we have a big messaging failure when it comes to what the federal government does. I think we absolutely do. And I can point to that graph Belle showed. Between 1994 and 2000, the trust in government numbers went up steadily for those 6 years. Then there's a peak in 2001, that's the 9/11, and then they slide back down. What was going on then? Bill Clinton was telling, and Al Gore were telling people that they were reinventing government. They were fixing it. They were breaking ashtrays. They were talking about all the silly stuff. They were getting rid of it, et cetera. This is not an insoluble problem, but it is a problem that has to be addressed if you want to get to any of the good ideas that are in Belle's book. You have to convince people that there is some level of competence. And I think you have to do that in a way that that Bill Clinton tried briefly in his administration, and nobody's tried before or since.
All right, so let's, I'll play economist here, and we'll assume we've fixed government, trust in government, and insoluble divisions between the political parties. So let's move on to ideas, at least temporarily. Eric and then Jared, I'm giving you a magic wand, and I'm allowing you the one best idea, though I will actually give you in your wand, you can have the ability to wave it back at me and to say, that's a really stupid question, Ruth, because there is no one best idea, or else it would have already been done, and what we need are a series of micro or interventions. But I'm asking you my question, and you can turn it back on me if you like.
Fair enough. Thank you. Well, first, it's great to be here. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here with this panel and a part of this conversation. Naturally, I received the book last week, so I said, oh, my God, I have a week to read the book and get through this and be prepared for this panel. And, of course, I started with the conclusion and then went to the intro. And as I was turning the pages, I kept thinking, oh, this is a great idea. Let me read more of this. And, you know, before I knew it, there was no page left behind and forgotten, right? I went right through it because a lot of the things, the proposals really do ring true to either proposals that have helped, you know, all Americans over time, or some pieces of that that we were building on in some important ways that I think were crucial to cover. So I appreciated the breadth. I also have to say that coming from the civil rights community, I've appreciated the way that Bell really included the notion of race and other communities in the book. We have seen many books come out about inequality and forgotten Americans where it's kind of in the intro, yes, racism matters, but we're moving on. But this, I think, did justice to at least communicating that this is important, an important part of our understanding about what's happening. And I say that because that's important to thinking through how we move from this point forward, you know, given the way that our politics have aligned with race in the way that we think about solutions and working together. So the proposal that was important to me was the National Service proposal. It was the one proposal that brought together the notion of humanizing communities as well as trying to create a benefit. And I say that because I firmly believe at this stage in what we're seeing that racial resentment and racial animus and identity, white identity, the country's identity, are far more important in factoring into our politics than perhaps we give it credit. And that hinders our ability to come together around a common economic agenda. And I think that's important for us to talk about. And I think that's important for us to address. The one missing dimension that I felt was important to lift up was not immigration, but immigrants, right? And the fact that we have 5 to 6 million U.S. American children that have an undocumented parent in their household. That is the future of our country, and they're living in fear. And the current system that we have in place is undermining the parents' ability to work, undermining the kids' ability to have education and pursue that, and threatening to separate them from their families and their parents, right? That's happening right now, right, as we think about the future. So I think there needs to be more conversation about that because our policy system and our political system has not been created to digest those issues properly. The thing that I think we could all agree is that if tomorrow we introduced every single proposal in this book, minutes later there would be anti-immigrant amendments that people would see attached to every one of those proposals. You just can't get around that. That's just kind of the reality. So the one that sticks out for me is the one that addresses the humanizing of segments of our community with the interests of the country. And that's the only way I believe we're going to be able to move forward together.
All right. Now, Jared, what's your idea?
Well, first of all, thank you, Ruth, and thank you, Bell, for inviting me and for writing such a great book. People sometimes compliment me on my ability to write clearly about complex economics, and then I read Bell, and I see how much further I have to go. It really, and so the clarity, but the other
astrologist,
right? Maybe that's it. And the other part of the book that I really commend to you is you really see someone who's got, you know, a very big brain but an equally big heart struggling with very hard questions. And that just really comes out off of the page, Bell's earnestness in trying to think about these problems. And there are a lot of Tony economists at her level that don't bother doing that. So I am endlessly thankful for her work in that regard. So let me be somewhat uncharacteristically a bit more positive than some of the other voices we've heard today, and starting with some of the things that Bill was just talking about. Bill to my left was talking about regarding trade and technology, and then I'll wind up and try and answer your question. So if the notion is that the pace at which labor-saving technology is displacing workers in the American labor force, and that the pressures of trade are also having those kinds of impacts due to import competition, it's kind of hard to square with the economy and the labor market that we see right now in front of us. We have an unemployment rate that's almost at a 50-year low, 3.7%. We're creating jobs at a pace that most economists didn't think was plausible at this late stage in an economic expansion. By that, I just mean it's an older expansion. I'm not saying that it's going to end anytime soon, because economists can't really predict recessions, and expansions don't really die of old age, so we don't know. But it is year nine, and yet there's more capacity out there, more room to run, as we sometimes hear Fed chairs say, which actually has bearing on where I'm about to go next. The problem is job quality, and this actually comes right out of Bell's work. People were saying we didn't have so much trouble finding a job, but it was the quality of that job. And there I take your point about the downward pressure that trade puts on wages. Well, that's something that can handily be addressed by policy, and I'll leave it. I'm unlike many others on the panel, including Bell, I'm not really talking about the politics right now. Obviously, without them, we get nowhere. I'm not dismissing that. I'm just saying there are people here more qualified to talk about the politics. But here, the policy, as Ruth asked, whether it's a minimum wage, expanded earned income credit, Bell has an idea to build on top of that, a workers' credit. Those are all plausible ways to improve the quality of jobs when the quantity is strong. And then you might say, well, wait a second, do we have enough income to do something like that? Well, we have more wealth per capita than we've ever had. It's just extremely concentrated at the top of the scale. So yes, there will have to be some type of redistribution to make that occur, and that is part of Bell's solutions as well. In terms of the policies, well, I've already been tagged as an advocate of full employment, and I very happily and willingly wear that tag. And I think maintaining full employment is key. As I said, we're just now at 3.7%, almost a full percentage point below where the Federal Reserve tells us is the lowest unemployment rate sustainable with stable prices. So the natural rate of unemployment, clearly they pegged that too high. So here we are in territory we haven't been at for decades, and we haven't seen that much wage pressure. Well, we're starting to see a bit more now. And my prediction, and you can write me nasty tweets if I'm wrong, is that over the next couple of quarters, we're
nasty
going...
Nasty tweets?
Yeah, can you imagine?
Hard to believe.
It's hard to imagine. I do have a policy. The minute somebody sends me a nasty tweet, I block them. So one strike and you're out is the way I play it. But that's neither here nor
there. That must explain something.
My followers are dwindling. But anyway, my point is that I do believe we're going to start seeing some real wage gains in coming quarters. So I think full employment really does work, and I think there are monetary and fiscal policies that can help maintain that. In the interest of time, I won't speak to them. I'll just finish with this. Bell talks about the importance of a subsidized employment program. I very much endorse that and would underscore the point that there are numerous ideas that have now been written into legislation on Capitol Hill, all Democrats, none of them going anywhere anytime soon. But they exist on a continuum from a very mildly interventionist idea, which Bell puts in her book, to a guaranteed job that Richard asked about earlier, that is at the other end of the continuum. I think there's actually very good ideas along that continuum. I'd probably put myself more in the middle of it, where Bell is on the less interventionist side, without going all the way to the guaranteed jobs. But I think that is my policy solution. Maintain full employment, but because there are places and people that full employment doesn't reach, you need a subsidized employment program as well.
So I want to kind of encourage everybody to jump into the fray here, but I didn't want to pigeonhole Lane and Bill as the political types with no policy brains, because they are policy brains as well. So, Bill, do you want to say something really briefly about what you've heard so far, and then maybe Elaine and Bill can jump in?
I think we should continue.
All right. Elaine, you have the wand.
I think I want to say two things about the politics of this. Okay, first of all,
I asked you about policy. I was giving you the policy opportunity.
Policy?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't.
No, but you can do
you.
Politics. Whichever you think.
Let me start with policy then. One of the things I love about Bell's book is that she understands and emphasizes the value of work. I really dislike all these policy proposals to have a guaranteed income. It would so undermine our democracy. It would so create two. We worry about class. Imagine the class system that would develop with those who work and those who don't. That would be just awful. And I think that what Bell hit on here is a sort of core essential value that sometimes my party loses sight of, which is the psychological value of work and how important that is. And so I think that that's absolutely critical. And supporting work through worker tax credits, the EITC. I mean, look, the EITC was the biggest increase in poverty spending in the century. Okay, in the century. Nobody gets that. Right? No, absolutely nobody gets that. It started out as a Republican idea. The New Democrats stole it, okay, blew it up, increased it a lot. And now the Republicans have turned against it, right? The Republicans have turned against the EITC because they say, oh, well, the people don't have a stake in the system if they don't pay income taxes. And there's a lot of people who are not paying income taxes. So
they actually go back and forth. This year's CEA report actually calls for an expansion of the EITC. A small one.
Oh, well, oh, that's good to know. Yeah. In any event, I think that the emphasis on work is critical, and we have to keep our eye on that ball in all policy development because it is such a core value, and get away from the extreme, and Bell also touches on this, the extreme redistributionist side of it. That doesn't work in America. I don't know how many times Democrats have to try it and fail to see that it just doesn't work. And so I think those are two, they're almost value and messaging issues that should be at the core of the policy.
So Elaine, the EITC redistributes about $70 billion a year from high-income people to low-income people. So why is that okay with you? What is it you're against?
What I'm against?
I feel like I should just get out of the way of this. There's no debate that's nastier between a new Democrat and an old Democrat, you know. And I always enjoy them personally, so I feel like
I'm not at all being nasty. I'm just teasing you, Janet. I think you mean something different.
Well, no, what I mean is the EITC is about work. It's grounded in work. And I think that's the core value that I'm trying to get at here. And I think that's what Bell talks about in the book.
I'll just say a word on the policy thing, and then we can get back to the class warfare versus non-class warfare stuff and everything. I mean, I actually agree with Jared in some certain respects and in many respects, but I still think the relative disadvantaging of less well-educated workers in America is something that's very hard to see how you fix with moderate or incremental policy proposals. You can do as much with the EITC as you can do. You still then have the problem of less participation in the workforce, which doesn't really help those. So the EITC doesn't help unless it drags them in. You could argue maybe, but it doesn't directly help those who have stopped participating in the workforce and which presumably aren't captured in the unemployment numbers. So I think it just is a big structural challenge which requires fresh thinking. And to some respect, it may be something that one goes through as a society, as an economy for a decade or two. It's easy for me to say this, and it sounds heartless. No politician will put it this way. But, there are just macro, huge economic trends that one can't fully compensate for or deal with. But I agree with Jared in this way, but coming at it from almost the opposite. In a weird way, I wonder, isn't it easier to do big things than small things in public policy? So, I mean, you would, I think.
I don't know. Ask President Obama.
But he found this too, I think, in some ways, which is, there's a Keynesian side of this, which is, look, these, it's in a way easier to have higher economic growth than to figure out how to allocate the rewards of economic growth in some micro, clever, targeted way. That does assume government working better than I think it often does work, and it forgets about all the unanticipated consequences of various government policies. And then from a sort of, let's say, conservative, or I don't know what you call it, Hayekian point of view, I just have a skepticism that government knows how to do these things that well. Whereas, it wasn't messaging. I mean, what the Clinton years, people had more trust in government because their incomes were going up from 95 to 2000. They started to lose trust in government when their income stopped going up, middle-class incomes. They kind of interrupted the secular stagnation or decline that has been going on for three decades or so. So I regard that as just a policy triumph of Clinton. It was not loved by the left. It was not loved by the right. It was a pretty conventional, I think you could argue, economic policy. James Carville complained that the bond market was running the country, but it turned out that actually having responsible debt and deficit policies was a good idea. It could accommodate, obviously, some policy initiatives like EITC. You get a huge end of Cold War dividend, which helps you. And then you get, you know, a tech bubble, and it gets a little complicated. But still, I think it's a policy success, which suggests that, I mean, I wonder if the system is now too broken to respond to policy successes. That would be an interesting question, or not, or whether it can't produce those kinds of policy successes. But I think that's actually encouraging in the sense that people aren't just foolish. You know, they really became unhappy again with government when government stopped performing well. So I don't quite agree that government's doing such a great job. I mean, I do think, I mean, Bush and Obama, they were, I mean, 08, and I'll say against my own interests, some of the foreign policy failures of Bush, the crash of 07, 08, that was not supposed to happen. We had worked that all out. Alan Greenspan, Ben Bernanke, I know Ben Bernanke is a sainted figure and he's probably sitting here or something, but you know, if anyone looked at the Fed, and I shouldn't say this with economists, if anyone actually looked at the Fed minutes from like 06, 07, 08, they did not understand what was going on. So I do not have such faith that we can, you know, figure these things out so wonderfully. But I think the citizenry had, in a way, a sensible response, which was these experts do not know as much as they claim to know about what they're talking about. Now, the response they seized upon is very damaging, in my view, to the country and conceivably to the global economy. And in that respect, final point, I'm sort of slightly hostile to those who, we elites are out of touch, we have to get in touch, we have to listen to people. I'm all for that. But if listening to people means actually pursuing policies that make them worse off, which is, in my view, would be some of the policies on trade, or scapegoating immigrants, or not dealing humanely and seriously with the people who are already here, or in my view, actually cutting back on more immigration of certain kinds, which would probably be a big help for economic growth in a macro level, which would be very good for the country. I'm not interested in sort of, I understand in politics you have to accommodate, but I think it's a little unfair to accuse politicians of, like, they try to find the right policy. The Republicans, I will say, the establishment Republicans, whom everyone derides, hung on to free trade when no one else was doing it, supported Obama's free trade messages, tried to pass with the Democrats, obviously, an immigration bill in 2013. And, you know, so they tried in a way to hang on to what they thought were reasonable policies. It turned out that they were unpopular politically, but it's a little hard to criticize them for trying to do what they thought was the kind of right thing for the country.
So, good. I wanted to bring you in here.
Yeah, I'm not going to react to all of that, but just to say a couple of things that, and there was a lot I agreed with in what you said, but a couple of things that I think that Bell's book does touch on is that we did just do something big with the tax cut that we passed, and that was enormously tilted in one direction. And as long as we continue on that kind of trajectory, we're going to have longer term.
But it's unpopular. And yes, the Democrats might actually run on that a little more. Probably with Jared. You know, this is actually a good issue for the Democrats, as is health care. I mean, they should get back to basics on the left and stop, you know, thinking that every culture war fight is an automatic victory for them.
but a couple of things that were in the book that I also thought were important was, one is that a part of the solution going forward has to be the private sector and thinking about how you can use the tax code or the corporate tax code to realign incentives and think about training and investments. I thought was quite intuitive and makes a lot of sense as we think about the future. The other was we have to deal with the estate tax, right? Because what is passing on non-worked earnings to the next generation over and over and over again, over generations and the accumulation of that. Over time, how do we get more of that to invest in the places that we think is important? So I thought those were two important contributions to this part of the conversation I didn't want to leave behind.
You know, it's interesting. You've identified two particular pieces of what Bell's talked about. One is the notion of national service, and the other is the estate tax and regaining revenue from the estate tax. And I have to say that while I find myself agreeing with both of those instincts and think that America would be a better country if those solutions were implemented, I'm also not at all convinced, other than being able to use that estate tax revenue for a better purpose, that either of those in and of themselves would address some of the fundamental forgotten American issues that we've been talking about. Please discuss.
Well, I find myself having some difficulty wrapping my head around the conversation because it all sounds so large and insolvable in a way. You have to get the politics right. You have to get the communication right. But you can't. You have to, as Bill said, if you don't want to listen to people who have bad ideas, you want to listen to their good ideas. And how much do we really understand about people anyway when we go out and talk to them for, you know, a couple of weeks or a few focus groups? So I think the best thing to do is to get down to basics. And what was a very elegant aspect of Bell's book is she identifies the basics as family, education, and work. And I got to say, that just makes a lot of sense to me. And of those three basics, Bell, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, you're the author right here, so she can do that. I think work gets a little more heavily weighted of those three.
In the short run.
In the short run, okay. And so we need to, so that maybe makes the question here something you can maybe think about and deal with, which is that, you know, there are places, and they tend to be as far as you can imagine from the corner where you can get a latte macchiato, where labor demand isn't that strong, even at low unemployment. So I'm talking about rural parts of America. I'm talking about parts of America that used to have a manufacturing base that has been significantly diminished. And here is where lots of economists who used to think about the solution for that kind of a problem was for people to move somewhere else. You know, a politician would never tell you this. You know, go to some other district. But the economist would say, pick up and go to the city. That's and in fact, geographical mobility has diminished. Bell points this out in her book. And so you can't say that. You have to bring more economic activity to people. And I actually think that could be done through a pretty aggressive subsidized employment program. In fact, I would go further than Bell's. She, in my view, kind of nips a little bit around the edges by just targeting the people who are most disadvantaged. I would argue that there are places in this country that have great needs, infrastructure needs, human childcare and educational needs, and there just isn't enough investment income, isn't enough economic activity to pay for that. And so, yeah, if you wanted to do it in a way that was that Ruth would make Ruth Marcus happy and have it be deficit neutral,
I knew that was coming.
Then you'd have to raise some revenue through some part of the tax code, and people like to pick on the wealth tax because it's so egregiously unfair, and you know, put me down as an advocate of that as well. But however you do it, or even if you have to, God forbid, put it on the deficit, I think that's the way to go. I think we should bring more economic activity to places where it's not reaching, and we should be pretty content that it is reaching a lot of other places as we speak.
Maybe I could ask a question to Bell.
We're going to lightning round ourselves here, and we're going to end the lightning round with a last word from Bell.
Okay, so I'll just ask, you can have, in your last word, you can answer that. I mean, so I think you've emphasized as much as anyone family, education, and work, and the formulations, you and Ron, and about, you know, getting out of high school and not having kids and staying out of jail and so forth. And I totally agree with that. But the book, of course, is heavy on the work side because family has been, A, dealt with by other people analytically, and B, is extremely hard. Yes, and it's extremely hard.
The book is going to be on education.
Right. Well, so family is extremely hard to deal with in a free society with a government, and education shouldn't, well, who knows if it should or shouldn't be, has been extremely hard to deal with education reform in a serious way for 30, 40 years. So work seems like the one has the biggest lever on, because it's more responsive, presumably, to much more direct things government is used to doing, like EITC and minimum wage and whatever, and deregulation, if you want to look at the, you know, encouraging the people who are employing the workers and so forth. But how, this is an honest question, how much is the work lever worth compared to the other two? And I think if Charles Murray or Bob Putnam were sitting here, they would like the book and they would be friendly to it, but they would say, compared to these other forces, you know, you're sort of having, you're just as limited reward for the for all doing all the, even if the political system were fixed and we did all these good things, how much really would it change the situation we're looking at out there?
That very quickly, you know, what I would say to this is, no, we're not going to solve, we can't solve everything. We cannot solve cultural problems from the government. We can't solve long-term structural problems from the government. What can we do? We can do the sort of things that are in Bell's book. And in order to do those, though, we need to get to a point where the population says, yeah, government can do some things. And I think that's very important. And that's been a major impediment. There are things the government can do. And we need to cross that barrier before we can get to then some realistic policy.
Well, to answer Bill's question about work, education, and family, in the short run, if you're talking about what would do the most to help the most people over a few years' time, work is it. But if you're talking long term, then a better education system and more healthy, stronger families might be more important. I actually believe it depends upon the time frame where you come out.
All right. I'm sorry.
Can I just really echo something that Eric brought up that I'm worried is getting lost here? The Tax Cut Act of 2017 gave away, you know, we can debate the number, but you know, at least $1 trillion and probably more like $2 trillion. And we didn't get anything back for it. It was a giveaway. Now, I understand there are economists who believe that money will be used to increase investment, increase productivity, and eventually you'll see a wage effect. We had a wonderful paper here written by one of our best conservative and one of our best liberal economists trying to figure out what the long-term impact over the next 10 years that tax bill would be. The impact on growth was tiny, and they agreed to that. This is not a liberal conservative thing. And to me, the issue here is not just, you know, where are we going to get the money and how are we going to fix our politics? It's couldn't we be a little more sensible about cost benefit here? This had a huge cost and a very uncertain benefit. And to go back to Eric's point, we really do need to nudge the private sector in some new directions. We could have used that money. We could now amend this bill. We could replace, we could repeal and replace it even. I hate to use that phrase, but we could and use that money to help workers have more of a stake in the success of the economy. So I'm very big on that idea, and I think it hasn't been talked about enough.
So I think couldn't we all be a little more sensible here is the overarching title of the Isabel Sawhill trilogy. So we'll be back in a few years to talk about education. I really look forward to it. Thank you to Brookings, to Bell, to this very distinguished panel, and to the audience. Thank you.
Let me just add my thanks to Ruth for moderating that panel. Please join me in thanking Ruth.